convincing. He immediately grasped its immense possibilities and purchased the film rights for $50,000. George Cukor was to direct, and Selznick said he wanted Hepburn for the role, at first. Over the next few months, Selznick heard from every important actress and her agent in Hollywood. While much has been said over the years about how Selznick ultimately believed Clark Gable as Rhett Butler would never go through years of the war lusting after Katharine Hepburn, it was, in fact, the actress's greatest supporter who first dissuaded the producer from casting her. George Cukor, as Kate herself related, felt that it was unsuitable for me, that I was a heroine and Scarlett was this wicked sort of sexual creature. That Cukor, who was the director of the film from its earliest days of pre-production to its first days of filming, felt so strongly about Kate's unsuitability gave Selznick license to keep widening his search. The longer Selznick delayed in casting his lead, the larger his problem became, as the search for Scarlett became an international treasure hunt, one of great interest among moviegoers. As the date by which they had to start filming approached, Hepburn went to Selznick and said, "David, you've got to have an unknown girl in the part. You've made this big thing now, and you have to deliver. You can't cast me or anyone else who is well known, because audiences would walk in with certain expectations." At the same time, she still dreamed of playing the role. So she made one last-ditch play. "Look," she said, "you've got Walter Plunkett doing the clothes, and Walter knows me backwards. He could do 5 costumes in one night for me and would. So if you're stuck, you can just let me know 24 hours before it's too late." Hepburn didn't like being in a second or possibly 10th position like that, but she knew her only prayer at getting the role lay in some desperate act of midnight casting. Hardly a week later, Selznick met Vivian Leigh, and the contest was over. While Gone with the Wind was being filmed, most of the other leading ladies in Hollywood were busy appearing in what would prove to be signature roles, contributing to what would become the most glorious year in Hollywood history, 1939. Garbo was in Ninotchka. Crawford played her first important unsympathetic bitch role in The Women, alongside Norma Shearer, Rosalind Russell, Paulette Goddard, and Joan Fontaine. Greer Garson debuted in Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Betty Davis was in The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex, Dark Victory, The Old Maid, opposite Miriam Hopkins, and Juarez as the Empress Carlotta. Jean Arthur was in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with Jimmy Stewart, and Only Angels Have Wings with Cary Grant. Irene Dunne made Love Affair with Charles Boyer. Ginger Rogers was twirling with Fred Astaire in The Story of Vernon and Irene Castle. Judy Garland went over the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz, and even Snow White got to cavort with 7 dwarfs. Katharine Hepburn, after 15 motion pictures in 6 years, was nowhere to be seen on the screen that year. She was instead trotting the boards in Wilmington, Washington, Boston, and the title city in The Philadelphia Story. For 5 weeks out of town, she and the play received rave notices, and the star begged the producers to keep the show on the road as long as possible, building up good word of mouth before coming into Broadway. "The critics are funny about me," she tried to explain to Philip Barry and the Theater Guild, her financial partners in the venture. "They'll just land on me." Despite the vehemence of her protest, they outvoted her, and the Philadelphia Story opened at the Schubert Theater on March 29, 1939. The play was a huge hit, Kate's assessment, critically and financially. But it took a while before it performed the trick she hoped it would, providing the opportunity to reprise the role on film. She employed an agent named Harold Friedman, who represented playwrights and a handful of actors, such as the Lunts, but forbade him from telling anybody that she controlled the film rights. Indeed, all the major studios called, hoping to buy the source material for their biggest stars. But upon his client's instructions, Friedman stalled them. Meantime, Hepburn carried on to nightly acclaim, playing more than 400 performances on Broadway. She would later play in another 250 performances on the road. In the end, Hepburn made close to $500,000 in salary and profits. More important, the play had warmed up enough audiences nationwide to rekindle her career. After the play had packed houses for a year, Howard Hughes approached the studios on behalf of the film rights co-owner. Because he kept a private office for himself on the Samuel Goldwyn lot, he started there. Goldwyn was interested enough to send his number one director, William Wyler, to New York to convince Hepburn that they were the best team for the project. Sitting in the garden in Turtle Bay, she told the director exactly what she had told Goldwyn herself, that she would make a deal on the spot if they could deliver Gary Cooper to play C.K. Dexter Haven. She explained that this was not any kind of ploy for more money. It was simply that she had left Hollywood as box office poison, and she was smart enough to know that she needed a strong man or two by her side as antidotes. Although Cooper was under contract to Goldwyn at the time, he would not agree to play opposite Hepburn. Warner Brothers was willing to take a chance with her, offering a lot of money, the opportunity to produce the picture, and Errol Flynn. Hepburn was considering the deal when she got the call she had hoped for, from the biggest man in movies, Louis B. Mayer himself. He came to see the Philadelphia Story in New York with Norma Shearer on his arm and went backstage to offer his congratulations. The next day he called to say he wanted to come speak to her about the film. "Oh, no, Mr. Mayer," she said, remembering the way her mother used to influence the local powers in Hartford. "I'll come to you." In his New York office, L.B. Mayer said everything he could to wheedle the rights away from Hepburn so that Shearer might play the part. At last Hepburn said, "Mr. Mayer, you are deliberately charming me, and I know it, but the remarkable thing is that I'm charmed. Now, you're a real artist, but this property is not about making money for me. I'll sell it to you for exactly what I paid for it, without a dime of profit. It's quite simply about getting a good part for me, and I want only what would be a reasonable salary for myself. But what I really want from you are two stars." Mayer asked which two. "Gable and Tracy," she said, aiming for the top. Mayer said he doubted either of them would accept the offer, but that he would try them both. He promptly reported that one wasn't free, Tracy, she learned, and the other didn't want to do it. Despite Gable's star power, she was in truth just as happy not to get him, because she thought he was wrong for both parts, though he could have played the newspaper man, which is the part Spencer should have played. Then Mayer said, "I can give you Jimmy Stewart," who did not yet have much control over his roles, "and I'll give you $150,000 to get anyone else you can get." That was a lot of money, Hepburn thought, enough to allow her to call upon her friend Cary Grant. He was delighted with the offer, selected the role of C.K. Dexter Haven, and ultimately contributed his 3 weeks of salary to the British War Relief Fund. Mayer assigned Joseph L. Mankiewicz, one of the most formidable talents in Hollywood, to produce the picture. Permitted to choose her director, Hepburn considered nobody but George Cukor. "George saw the show in Chicago," Kate remembered, "and he thought it was awful, just plain awful. Not the play itself, which he liked, but the direction. Of course, that's partly because he didn't get to direct it. Now, I don't think he was being self-important in not liking it. It's more that George was a brilliant director who knew how to keep things moving all the time. He didn't believe in fussy business or lots of mannerisms, but he knew each character had to keep things moving at all times, that a good play had to be like a solar system in which all the planets are spinning in their orbits at all times. He felt our director, Bob Sinclair, hadn't done that. And of course," she added, "George really knew me, and he wanted to ensure that the film would be a great showcase for me." By then, Hepburn and Cukor spoke the same language. "And so when it came time to make the movie," Kate explained, "I said, 'Look, I don't want to make a grand entrance in this picture. Moviegoers haven't seen me in over a year, and they already made it clear that they think I'm too la-di-da or something. A lot of people want to see me fall flat on my face.'" "Or your ass," Cukor corrected. From that suggestion, Donald Stewart, the screenwriter who was adapting the play, devised what Hepburn considered an ingenious opening for the film. While Cukor had done a brilliant job in presenting Katharine Hepburn in A Bill of Divorcement, he would prove equally invaluable in recreating Katharine Hepburn in The Philadelphia Story. In the opening scene, Tracy Lord is throwing her husband, C.K. Dexter Haven, out of the house, golf clubs and all. When she cracks one of the clubs over her bended knee, she has gone too far. He comes back to push her in the face, knocking her right on her backside. "Oh, I loved it," Kate said. "Just what Tracy and I needed." The last time moviegoers had seen her, Katharine Hepburn was running off with Cary Grant at the end of Holiday. So she thought this scene would be as much fun for her fans as for those who didn't like her. "Although I must tell you," she said, "I truly believe that everybody still adored me, that it was nothing but bad material that had made me box office poison." In some ways, Kate said, The opening of this picture showed that running off with me could be fun and exciting, but that living with me was clearly no holiday. Life imitating art, she said, laughing hard. While Hepburn had never complained about the production values in her pictures at RKO and Columbia, she saw how they paled alongside the work of the legendary MGM production team in full force. Everything there was, as she said, top drawer. Joseph Ruttenberg, who had just won the first of his four Academy Awards for The Great Waltz, was the director of photography. Cedric Gibbons, who would win seven of those golden statuettes, which he had designed in the first place, was the art director. And Adrian, who designed clothes for Garbo, created the costumes, each one of Hepburn's outfits a vision. Franz Waxman wrote one of his most sophisticated scores. Every supporting player delivered a star turn, including Henry Daniel, Roland Young, and Ruth Hussey in the Shirley Booth role. And Kate said, "We got lucky again with the girl, this time little Virginia Weidler, who had me in stitches. She was so terrifyingly funny, I truly had a difficult time doing scenes with her. Honestly, I couldn't look at her, she was so funny." John Halliday, a veteran of the stage and silent screen, had the small but pivotal role of Seth Lord. He had the responsibility of delivering perhaps the play's most touching moment, a father summing up his daughter's wonderful attributes, but feeling compelled to add, "You have everything it takes to make a lovely woman except the one essential, an understanding heart. And without that, you might just as well be made of bronze." It is, of course, the stars of the Philadelphia Story who carry the day. Hepburn had never looked more glamorous nor been more commanding. She was an utterly contemporary woman, full of herself. Q Corps closely monitored her performance, allowing the audience to laugh at her enough so that they would ultimately sympathize with her. While many critics praised her for the originality of her performance and spoke of the emergence of a new Hepburn, she knew that she was, in fact, reverting to a former idol for inspiration. "I kept thinking of Hope Williams," she confessed. "I kept thinking how Hope could make everything so attractive, and how I must use all her tricks to keep Tracy from becoming a deplorable snob." While Cary Grant was at his most charming, full of humor and insouciance, Jimmy Stewart proved to be the revelation in the picture. In a role that got beefed up from the play because of the deletion of another character, that of Tracy's brother, Macaulay Mike Connor was more cynical than any Stewart had played before. And, Kate noted, "Jimmy had always been attractive, but for the first time I think he was very sexy. He was known, you know, as one of the great bachelors around town, but people outside the business just thought of him as this nice boy next door, without danger." That quality, Kate said, led to one of Q Corps' brilliant pieces of direction. Stewart had attempted his crucial speech in the film several times, the one in which he professes his love for the heroine, "You've got fires banked down in you," without nailing it. At last, Q Corps pulled him aside and said, "Now listen, Jim, just forget that you are that young boy running away to the circus, and play this scene absolutely straight." Kate said people never really understand what it is that a director can give an actor. That quick tip, she said, was a great example. Divine inspiration. Veteran Oscar watchers often assert that Jimmy Stewart's winning the Academy Award that year, over such contenders as Laurence Olivier in Rebecca and Henry Fonda in The Grapes of Wrath, was a consolation prize for his having failed to win the year before for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Hepburn disagreed. "I think Jimmy's absolutely brilliant in Philadelphia's Story and completely unexpected, and I think it was his big speech that put him over the top." Hepburn, in her signature role, lost the Oscar that year to Ginger Rogers and Kitty Foyle. Publicly, she said Ginger Rogers deserved to win. Privately, Kate said, "It's a silly part and a silly soap opera, and I'm still glad I turned the part down." The roaring success of The Philadelphia Story, almost $600,000 in 6 weeks at the Radio City Music Hall alone, put Hepburn on top again, especially in the eyes of the moguls. "Dad worshipped Kate. It's that simple," Irene Mayer Selznick told me of her father. "She represented everything that he thought was good about America. She had a tight-knit family, she had a first-class education, she had elegance, class without airs, and she had a good business head on her shoulders. She talked straight without ever compromising her femininity." More than once, Mr. Mayer called upon Hepburn to help straighten out one of his studio wunderkinds, Judy Garland. She had been desperately attempting to work her way out of a vortex studio doctors had created in which they had subjected her to amphetamines to help her lose weight and barbiturates to help her sleep. Mayer suggested to Hepburn that the young singing star's problem was a lack of character, one which Kate could help her overcome simply by being there for her, standing by as a good example. George Cukor later told me that Judy worshipped Kate, as did most of the women on the MGM lot. But it wasn't until years later that Hepburn realized to what extent the studio had been the agent of Garland's drug-addicted demise. "When I met Judy," Kate explained, "I didn't know what was wrong with her, and by the time I learned the source of her problems, it was too late for me to do anything about it." There was little either star could do but admire each other's talent. In the early 40s, when Louis B. Mayer sat front row center in the famous team photograph of his contract players, the one displaying more stars than there are in all the heavens, he insisted on Hepburn sitting to his right. Greer Garson was the other rose to flank the thorny Mayer. Irene easily understood her father's adoration of Kate, though she found it crazy-making. So much of what L.B. admired in Hepburn, he kept his own children from enjoying. Irene had a first-rate mind, for example, but it was prohibited from attending college because it would make her too smart to get a husband. Where Dr. Hepburn had thrust independence upon his children, Mayer had subjected his daughters to countless rules, all in service of his own whims and needs. Much of Kate's forthrightness in the Hollywood community stemmed from the fact that she was there virtually on her own. Unlike a great number of actresses whose mothers accompanied them as chaperones and managers, Hepburn slipped in and out of town alone, without the protection of a husband or even at that point an agent. Irene's father, on the other hand, ranted nightly about his 20-something daughters being unmarried, banging on the dining room table as he boomed, "Isn't it enough that I'm L.B. Mayer?" For several years, in fact, Irene and David Selznick had longed to marry, but Mayer had refused permission until her older sister Edie was married. Only 1 month after a producer named William Getz, a schlep with the filthiest mouth in town, said Irene, walked Edie down the aisle in one of the grandest weddings in Hollywood history, Irene and David married quietly. During one of my late nights at the Pierre, after several shots of Carrie's aquavit, Irene suddenly burst into tears, describing how she had secretly engineered the entire courtship of Getz and Edie. She confessed to making up positive remarks each had allegedly said about the other and making suggestions to her father that might advance Getz's career. "But," I said appeasingly, "the ends justified the means. The Getzes had a long marriage, certainly by Hollywood standards, and Edie said they were very happy. In fact, she even bragged that Bill was more successful than your father." "Doesn't that just tell you everything?" Irene said. "It's the thing I feel guiltiest about. But I had no choice." All the Mayers feuded the rest of their lives. Irene and Edie went decades without speaking to each other. Irene was always at odds with one of her two sons, and upon his death, L.B. left nothing to Edie or any of her children. "But in business," Kate said, "he was the most honest man I ever met in Hollywood, a straight shooter. We closed our deals with a handshake in his office. Then I would go to Benjamin K. Thaw, vice president of Lowe's, Inc., which owned MGM, to discuss the details. And when the contracts were drawn, I'd go to Mr. Mayer and say, 'Look, I don't have a lawyer, and I know you wouldn't cheat me, so would you please give this to one of your lawyers to look over for me?' He would and did." "I think that's what Dad liked most about Kate," Irene said in the end. "The trust. She brought out the very best in him." "Oh, these men, the Mayers and Goldwyns and the rest, make no mistake about it, they were pirates, real buccaneers," Hepburn said. "But they were also romantics and gamblers, and they weren't afraid to express their opinions and put their money where their mouths were, because they believed in the movies. The movies were their dreams, and I and Greer and Joan Crawford and Garbo, we were all part of those dreams." After the triumph of the Philadelphia story, Hepburn and Mayer were determined to work together again. The studio head even urged the star to become a director or producer. "I was a one-track Charlie," Kate used to tell him. "I was too interested in being a star to get bogged down in the details of the rest of the production." But she always made her voice heard on even the most minute points of every production, whether they affected her directly or not. She and Mayer did work together 10 more times over the next 15 years, on successive 3-year contracts, loose enough to amount to her working on an ad hoc basis. Upon filming the Philadelphia story, Kate honored her commitment to the Theater Guild by returning to the road, completing the tour of the show. She knew it could only create buzz for the upcoming release of the movie. Not until the film's premiere did the producers close the play appropriately in Philadelphia. On February 15, 1941, just before going on stage of the Forest Theater for the final performance, Hepburn went to the stage manager and said, "If I give you a sign at the end of the show, don't pull the curtain down. Let there be a pause." At each big moment in the play that night, the star realized from their reactions that practically everyone in the theater had seen the play before and that she was playing to a real fan audience. By the curtain calls, the crowd had gone absolutely mad. So Hepburn stepped forward for her final bow, coming out of Joseph Cotten's arms, thinking what a terrible moment it is when a play has to come to an end. She signaled to the stage manager, quieted the audience, and said to them, "The curtain will never be rung down on this play." With that, the cast simply walked off the stage. And as the audience left the theater for the streets of Philadelphia, the crew set out the work lights and dismantled the set. A few weeks later, Kate heard that Helen Hayes, the first lady of the American theater, whom she admired greatly, had said to a friend, "That goddamned Kate, resorting to that cheap little piece of business, when there are a million actors with a lot more hits. I can't believe I never thought of that." Commented Kate in the end with an enormous cackle, "I really should have been disgusted with myself." At the start of the new decade, however, she was feeling too good for that. Hepburn was in demand again. In 1940, Franklin D. Roosevelt invited her to Hyde Park, where she pledged support of a third term for the president in a radio broadcast. A few months later, Eleanor Roosevelt asked Hepburn to narrate an Office of War Information documentary called Women in Defense. Back in Hollywood, not only was L.B. Mayer pushing to make another picture with her, but writers were once again composing scripts with Hepburn in mind. Ring Lardner Jr., for example, was fashioning a story about a prominent newspaper columnist, modeled on Dorothy Thompson, who falls in love with her paper's sports writer. It was a natural setup for a witty battle of the sexes, rife with the comic possibilities imposed by the attraction of opposites. A centerpiece of the story would be the couples attending a baseball game together, turf that was as foreign to her as global affairs were to him. Lardner gave the story idea to his friend Garson Kanin, a young writer in Hollywood who was married to Ruth Gordon and was friendly with Hepburn, in hopes of drafting the script together. Hepburn liked Kanin and thought he was extremely clever, though she often found him quite full of himself. He was a good 15 years younger than his wife, and that always made Hepburn a little wary of him as well. "Princes," she said of spoiled men married to much older women, "looking for mother." All that aside, she liked this new idea. Kanin worked on the treatment with Lardner before enlisting in the armed services as the nation approached war. Then he suggested his younger brother might fill his boots in co-writing the script. The two fledgling writers, Michael Kanin and Lardner, wrote several drafts tailoring the character of Tess Harding for Hepburn. Just as important, Hepburn made clear from the start that the sports writer Sam Craig be skewed toward attracting the one actor with whom she most wanted to work, Spencer Tracy. Kate would later insist that she had no personal designs on Tracy in baiting this trap, only professional ones. She felt quite simply that he was the best movie actor there was. In 1940, that was a widely held opinion. Spencer Tracy had by then appeared in more than 40 pictures, playing everything from gangsters to priests, and winning back-to-back Oscars for his performances as Manuel the Portuguese Fisherman in Captain's Courageous and Father Flanagan in Boys Town. He had become something more than an actor or even a successful movie star. With his unaffected delivery, Tracy had become a national icon, appearing over and over as a kind of truth-teller in movies, the solid American. He was, Kate suggested in an incautious moment, completely male. And he was not afraid to turn that trait to sentimental use, maintaining a gruff exterior to disguise an obviously emotional inner life. She thought his performance in Fritz Lang's Fury, playing an everyman who stands up to a mob, was one of the greatest ever put on film, absolutely thrilling in its simplicity. And she told me one night, "I've watched Captain's Courageous at least 7 times, and I've never seen the end of it, because I'm always in tears once Spencer dies without letting the boy know he's lost his legs." When Hepburn thought Kanan and Lardner's extensive treatment was ready for the marketplace, she sent it to Joe Mankiewicz, without the writers' names on the pages. She gave him 24 hours to respond, not only to its quality, but also to its ability to entice Tracy. "I want him on no dice with MGM," she insisted. When Mankiewicz called to say it scored on both counts, she left for Los Angeles to meet with Mr. Mayer. As with the Philadelphia story, Hepburn controlled the material. Mayer asked how much she wanted for the story and who wrote it. She requested $125,000 for herself and as much again for the writers. She refused to name them, knowing novices could not demand that high a figure. When Mayer kept insisting on hearing their names, Hepburn sensed his vanity was about to get in the way of his negotiating a deal. Again, she remembered her mother with the elders in Hartford and how she never let her own ego detract from her causes. "Just pour the tea, Kath," Kate told herself. So before Mayer was forced into making a decision about buying the script, Hepburn quickly added that she had not come that day to close a deal, merely to see if MGM and Spencer Tracy were interested. Clearly Mayer was, enough for Hepburn to encourage her writers to polish the script. Tracy, unfortunately, was booked up, filming Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings's classic tale The Yearling in Florida. Hepburn didn't know at the time that The Yearling had been plagued from the start with bad weather and bugs, which were not only eating the actors alive, but also swarming around the camera, rendering much of the footage unusable. Providentially, the film soon shut down, and would not recommence for another 5 years, then starring Gregory Peck, and Spencer Tracy was looking for a new picture. The boys, as Kate called young Kanan and Lardner, completed their script post-haste. Tracy liked it, and committed to appear in it. In early August of 1941, Hepburn was walking out of the Thalberg building on the MGM lot when she saw Joe Mankiewicz walking with Spencer Tracy on their way to lunch. Although the two stars worked for the same studio, they had never met. They approached each other, and Mankiewicz made the unnecessary introductions. Kate held out her hand and sized up her new leading man from head to toe. Then she made a comment about her high heels and coquettishly remarked, "Mr. Tracy, you're not as tall as I expected." "Don't worry, Kate," Mankiewicz interjected. "He'll cut you down to size." Chapter 7. Yar. "How is your friend Irene?" Kate invariably asked at some point in every telephone conversation or visit. It was a loaded question, fraught with baggage, great interest tinged with melancholy. Katharine Hepburn and Irene Mayer Selznick had, after all, been friends for more than 50 years. Kate had known Irene through most of her 15-year roller coaster ride of a marriage to Benzedrine-fueled David Selznick, and they became closer in its aftermath when the divorced Irene reinvented herself as a major force on Broadway. For her part, Irene had been ringside for Kate's arrival in Hollywood, her exile, and then her comeback, as well as the 5 successful decades that followed. She had also observed Kate's serial love affairs of the 30s yield to the one serious romance that consumed her for the next 25 years. With one Selznick son or the other almost always on the outs with his mother, sometimes Jeffrey and Danny were in the doghouse at the same time, sister Kate became a favorite aunt to them. Despite all their shared history, by the end of the 1980s, the two women had all but stopped speaking to each other. But I can hardly remember a single telephone conversation or visit in which Irene did not ask, "How is your friend Kate?" They had experienced less of a rift than a drift, two seemingly parallel lives that gradually arced in different directions. Born a month apart, each entered her 80s differently. Irene, a lifelong hypochondriac, the only way to get attention growing up alongside a sickly sister, was proud of her age. While often complaining of undiagnosable aches and pains, she bragged that she had all her marbles and she worked steadily on a book of memoirs. Kate never said boo about her foot, which refused to heal properly. She stoically applied ice packs and stuck to her physical regimen as best she could, and she continued to entertain offers to work. She complained only that she couldn't remember things so well as she used to. For years I had been suggesting that she commit episodes of her life to paper, something I learned she had already quietly been doing, but their actual publication struck her as a kind of death knell to her acting career. She didn't celebrate birthdays, though every year, usually on the wrong date she had disseminated for publicity purposes back in 1932, the press ballyhooed the occasion. In May of 1989, her 82nd birthday, One newspaper announced that she had just turned 79. "It's bad enough that I have to get older every year," Irene dashed off in a note she mailed to Kate. "But do you have to keep getting younger?" Irene never received a reply. "The Kate I used to know would have called up and laughed," Irene told me a few nights later at dinner. Without ever saying a word directly on the subject, to each other or to me, their life paths seemed bound never to recross. For one, Irene didn't get around much anymore. While she was still full of piss and vinegar, as she used to say, on almost any topic, from politics to Broadway to her children, her social life was shrinking to long telephone conversations with her intimates, Kitty Carlisle Hart, Leonora Hornblow, Jean Kerr, and Mr. Paley, chief among them, and dinners for two in her apartment. Every now and then she would say to me, "I've got to have that bean soup at the post house," or "I've got to have some Chinese food tonight." And without a moment's thought, we'd tear down to Chinatown and eat five or six courses, each in a different restaurant, one specializing in dim sum, another in Sichuan soup, another in Peking duck. Such nights became rarer, and with each visit to the Hotel Pierre, I found her a little less willing to venture out. Kate, Irene claimed, was growing old disgracefully. After years of privacy and discretion, she appeared to be ubiquitous, needlessly grabbing headlines. There had been the performance she attended of Candide, at which the audience had to sit on benches so uncomfortable that she felt impelled to seat herself in a more comfortable chair, on the stage. While attending a play written by her niece, Catherine Houghton, Kate fainted to the floor, though no fault of her own, really. The paint fumes from the still-wet scenery simply knocked her out cold. She attended a Michael Jackson concert at Madison Square Garden as the artist's special guest, and she was appearing in a string of what Irene called horrible little television movies. "Dad always said Garbo had the right idea. Get off the screen while they still love you," Irene would add to underscore her point. Perhaps hardest for Irene was that Hepburn seemed to be chugging along with a new train of friends, mostly younger. Anthony Harvey, who had directed her in The Lion in Winter, was proving himself as caring a friend as he had been her director, in many ways replacing George Cukor in her life. Laura Frati, who had coached Kate in faking her piano playing in movies and on stage, came around with her intellectual husband and their daughter. Sally Lapidus, who had been a stage manager while Kate was performing the West Side Waltz on the road, accompanied her back to New York as a personal assistant and became a friend of Kate's prior to becoming a successful television writer-producer. "I remember when that phone number was a state secret and only a few of us had it," Irene recalled one night, somewhat wistfully. "Now everybody does." Mrs. Selznick, on the other hand, was in the phone book. "If you really don't want to be found," she once told me, "list yourself in the Manhattan Directory." Somehow Irene kept current on everybody who came in and out of Kate's life, through Nora, I always suspected, whom she liked a great deal and who was always up for a good gab. "And who's Cindy?" Irene asked me over the telephone late one night in 1983. "I'll be honest with you," I replied. "I haven't met her yet." "I think you better," said Irene, "because I think she's taken over your room at 244. Cindy was, in fact, a young woman from Maine named Cynthia McFadden, who had worked her way from Bowdoin College to Manhattan, where she apprenticed to the legendary newsman Fred Friendly. She became executive producer of his media and society seminars on public broadcasting, a stimulating series on moral, legal, and ethical issues, in which a law professor would hit fungo-like questions to a team of experts, batting them back and forth, Socratic style. A highly ambitious graduate of the Columbia University School of Law, Cynthia moved on to produce a show about books for Lewis Lapham. Cynthia's introduction to Kate came through Hepburn's sister Marion, who arranged for her to meet Kathy Houghton and Kate herself. A deep friendship quickly developed. One night, I called from Los Angeles and caught Kate in the middle of what sounded like a rousing dinner. "You should be here," she said. "I even have a dinner companion for you, a brilliant young girl. She has big, beautiful eyes, beautiful skin, and she wears her hair. Why, she wears her hair piled high and tied in a knot like..." "Tell him," I heard a young voice shout across the room. "I look like you." "Well, yes," said Kate, as though realizing it for the first time. "I suppose she does look like me." On my next visit to New York, I met Cynthia at dinner and found her as attractive as Kate had said, though not quite the lookalike I'd expected. Kate said she was sorry my room was currently occupied. Would I mind using another? I had, in fact, already made arrangements to stay with another friend across town. Over the next few years, Cynthia's friendship with Kate blossomed, as did her career. She was extremely attentive to Kate, treating her with respect and tenderness. This infusion of young blood, a woman starting out on her career in Manhattan and making Kate's home her own, had an obviously tonic effect. While Kate still preferred to arrange most of our dinners for just the two of us, we always had fun when Cynthia or Kathy Houghton or Tony Harvey came over. One night, Kate and Cynthia and I went to the home of Nancy Hamilton, a longtime friend from the theater. We were celebrating Cynthia's having taken the New York bar exam that day. After dinner, Nancy, a songwriter among many talents, wanted to play a record of Kirsten Flagstad singing Wagner. Kate could not have been less interested. She tried to get Nancy Hamilton to turn off the machine and return to conversation, but Nancy would not stop the music. Kate fired a desperate look my way, suggesting that I do something. At the close of an aria, I just sat down at the piano and started playing, making it impossible for our hostess to ignore me. The first song that came to mind was Coco, a number Kate had performed several hundred times. After playing it from start to finish, Kate looked puzzled and said, "Play that again," which I did. Looking even more puzzled, she asked, "What is that song? I know I've heard it." I laughed until I realized she wasn't kidding. "Heard it," I said. "You sang it 400 times. It's Coco." "Oh, Christ," she said. "I knew there was a reason I couldn't remember it. I couldn't stand that song." Cynthia was always interested in meeting new people, and she tended to make Kate more social, even less averse to appearing in public. Besides accepting the occasional dinner invitation, Hepburn increasingly found herself on the town during the day, occasionally performing unnecessary tasks. One day we had to find the perfect carrot peeler. Kate's driver took us to three different stores before we found an emporium selling kitchen utensils that had the exact size and model she wanted. I was fascinated to watch a dozen shoppers in that store near Union Square all suddenly develop an interest in carrot peelers and to see Kate's way of noticing them without being noticed. While Kate and Phyllis went to the cash register to pay for the item, Kate never carried cash, just a checkbook. Phyllis was there to pull out a roll of bills from a change purse of household money. I lingered with the crowd. 11 out of 12 shoppers bonded in excitement. "Is it really her? She still looks great. She's my grandmother's favorite. She's my mother's favorite. She's my favorite." One severely tailored, middle-aged matron said, "I always thought she overacted." I reported the results of my straw poll to Kate, who said I should always tell people she was my aunt, so they would be polite enough not to criticize her, at least in our presence. Kate was back to seeing every show on Broadway, and she often asked if we might duck out to the movies, though little interested her there. She avoided action pictures and couldn't believe that Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger were international stars. "I don't understand him," she said of the latter, after we had seen a preview of one of his movies. As I tried to explain the worldwide appeal of the Austrian-born bodybuilder, she said, "No, I mean when he speaks. I don't understand him." She found most of the Merchant Ivory pictures a boa, though she delighted in Vanessa Redgrave's performance in their production of The Bostonians, or any role she ever saw her in. She had flipped for John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, and she greatly admired Sally Field in Norma Rae and Places in the Heart. She liked Harrison Ford in The Mosquito Coast and again in Working Girl. She said the new star of that picture, Melanie Griffith, reminded her of Judy Holliday, but feared her career would fade fast. "There's something lethargic about her," she explained, "where Judy was full of energy." She had zero tolerance for Woody Allen movies, though she thought The Purple Rose of Cairo captured the flavor of the RKO movies of her vintage. After seeing Julia Roberts in Mystic Pizza, she predicted her becoming the next big movie star, the first she had seen in years. Meryl Streep was her least favorite modern actress on screen. "Click, click, click," she said, referring to the wheels turning inside her head. Glenn Close was her least favorite actress on the stage. "She's got these big, fat, ugly feet," Hepburn told me upon returning from a matinee of Tom Stoppard's play The Real Thing, in which Close had opened on Broadway opposite Jeremy Irons. "And she goes around barefoot in the play and almost ruins the whole thing." She thought Irons gave a spectacular performance, though she didn't think he was a well-trained actor. "It's a personality performance," she said, "all tricked up with mannerisms and charm, like me." On the other hand, she admired Irons' wife, Sinead Cusack, who was in New York around that time performing with Derek Jacobi in the Royal Shakespeare Company in Much Ado About Nothing and Cyrano de Bergerac. Hepburn thought she was the real McCoy, one of the most exciting actors I've ever seen. Glenn Close's feet notwithstanding, Kate insisted I see the real thing. She thought Stoppard was a cold playwright, but that this was the most emotional work he had written. She wangled two house seats for a Wednesday matinee, one for me and one for your friend Irene. Irene would later assert that Irons' performance was one of the three greatest performances she had ever seen, ranking alongside Brando's in Streetcar. The third great performance she would later cite was John Lithgow's in Requiem for a Heavyweight, which had been adapted from a Rod Serling teleplay for a short-lived Broadway run. In addition to the tickets, Kate invited us back to her house for dinner that night. The invitation thrilled Irene and led to an amusing evening. I sat back and listened as these two old friends hopscotched across half a century of show business acquaintances, all the obvious Hollywood names, plus some mutual Broadway friends, producer Hugh Binky Beaumont, agent Audrey Wood, Lillian Hellman, Tallulah Bankhead. And do you remember how Myron was always betting on that goddamned horse named Malicious? Irene asked. Always a long shot, and it paid off every time. The next morning, Kate said it had been nice to see Irene, but all she talks about are aches and pains and dead people. Irene said it had been nice to see Kate, but you're the only one of her friends that I can stand. Although she hadn't met Cynthia McFadden, she didn't like the sound of her. She bristled at Kate's extreme interest in the young woman's career. She occasionally asked longingly about my visits to Fenwick, wondering, who makes the beds? I said everyone seemed to make his or her own, and if I was ever slow about it, Kate would just march in and make it. That's what I was afraid of, said Irene. She returned only once more in her life to 244 East 49th Street. I finished my Goldwyn biography in the late spring of 1988, a rocky moment in the history of my publishers, Alfred A. Knopf. The firm's longtime standard-bearer and my editor, Robert Gottlieb, had recently decided to leave the publishing house upon being offered the editorship of The New Yorker. A brilliant gentleman from London, Sonny Mehta, replaced him, and my book was assigned to one of Gottlieb's protégés to edit. I handed over the 1,200-page manuscript on which I had worked for some 8 years and made a plea few editors ever hear. Please, I begged, cut anything you can out of this manuscript. I feel it's about 400 pages too long, so if anything even makes you pause for a moment, please mark it as material I might cut. 4 months later, the editor returned the manuscript to me, shorter by 12 pages. As she put the book into production, I sent this edited version to Irene. A day later, she called to say, "You've sent me the wrong pages. I've got one of your rough drafts." After I explained that this was the edited version, Irene said that was unacceptable. She strongly felt that the material was all there, but that much of it was out of proportion. If that was the best Knopf was going to do with my book, she said, she would just have to edit the book herself. For the next 10 days, she did just that, working it over word by word. Twice a day, she would call outraged by something. "Zsa Zsa Gabor's in your book, but no Pearl White," she screamed one day, reminding me that I had left out the silent screen's most famous cliffhanging heroine. Her edited version had marginalia everywhere, all perfectly precise. When she had reached a paragraph I'd written about John Hall, the star of Goldwyn's production of The Hurricane, for example, she simply wrote in the margin, "Sonny Tufts," a reference to a second-string leading man who also didn't warrant much attention. The Pierre was featuring a special chef that week she was playing editor, and Irene recommended that we sample his food one night in her apartment while discussing the manuscript. Over turbo with an intense lobster sauce, she pointed out stories that ran on for pages that should be condensed to paragraphs, paragraphs that should become sentences, and sentences that should become two-word mentions. When we reached the pages I had written about a terrible Goldwyn picture called A Song Is Born, I spoke of simply cutting most of it. Upon hearing that, Irene grabbed a piece of bread out of my hand and mopped her plate clean of the remaining sauce. "What made that sauce so good?" she asked rhetorically. Before I could speak, she provided her own answer. Reduction. The next morning, Irene called to say that she had just called His Nibs, Bob Gottlieb, whom she looked upon as a third son, and gave him hell. She suggested I rework the draft as quickly as possible and send the revised pages to him, even though he had already assumed his duties at the New Yorker. Irene's comments helped me reduce the manuscript by 300 pages. Then Bob Gottlieb moonlighted for a few days, living up to his legendary reputation and finding another 100 pages on top of that. With the book at last on the production schedule, I began searching for my next topic. An editor at Knopf introduced me to the executrix of the Tennessee Williams estate, Maria Grenfell, Lady St. Just, who was then actively searching for a Williams biographer. This was a brass ring in nonfiction circles. Arguably America's greatest playwright, the debate still rages between pro-Williams and pro-O'Neill camps, Williams left a massive collection of unpublished material, and a well-researched, well-written life story of the man had not yet appeared. The Lady St. Just was a colorful character, reputedly Williams' model for Maggie in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and a former actress who had married a Morgan Bank heir. Upon her longtime friend Tennessee's death, she was left to oversee his literary matters. "I remember when she was working the streets," Irene told me when I discussed my having dinner with her. Our meeting was such a triumph that the next day the Lady St. Just literally pulled me by the hand to two different law offices to meet her co-executors and to arrange for my securing the necessary rights and permissions to the Williams archives. A lovely man and friend of mine named Lyle Leverage had been researching a Williams biography for years, working from authorization by Williams himself. But the estate was trying to block him at every turn, including their ultimate threat that they would prohibit his quoting any Williams material. I figured I might be influential with the estate in allowing Leverage to publish his work, knowing that I would have access to material he did not have, and that my book would be published at least a decade later. After everything seemed to be arranged for me to write the official biography, all too quickly, I thought, especially after one of the attorneys showed me Leverage's authorization and commented, "It's not exactly the wine-soaked cocktail napkin Maria says it is," I went to the Hotel Pierre, bursting with my good news. "Congratulations," Irene said upon learning the offer. "Now run like hell." I didn't have to sell the producer of A Streetcar Named Desire on the importance of my subject, but she felt compelled to tell me that my writing such a book would be like entering a snake pit. She suggested that I would never survive working with that woman, Maria St. Just, and that Tennessee Williams's affairs were as big a cesspool after his death as they had been during his lifetime. I was happy to have somebody with whom I could discuss all aspects of the story before I signed a decade of my life away, and I made all the compelling counter-arguments about the drama of Williams's life. Irene listened to my earnest oral argument, staring at me through her glasses. At last, she closed the debate by saying, "Lousy third act." Before I left her that night, she urged me to discuss the subject with your friend Kate. Hepburn had, after all, played two of Tennessee Williams's juiciest parts, Violet Venable and Amanda Wingfield, and he had written another, Hannah Jelks, in Night of the Iguana, for her. I stopped by 2:44 the next day. "I am afraid," Kate said, "Irene's right. Tennessee's life was a nightmare, a total nightmare, and I don't think you'll ever wake up. You really don't want to spend years with those people, his people." Kate had just read the finished manuscript of Goldwyn, for which she unsolicitedly called my publishers and gave them an advertising blurb, and said, "That man was a pirate, but there was lift to his life. I didn't much care when he died in real life, but I did when he died at the end of the book. I don't think you'll feel the same about Tennessee. His life was one long suicide. He dragged people down in the gutter with him, and I'm afraid he'll drag you, too." I rethought. But even before I could express my doubts to anyone, the Lady St. Just, of whom many joked she was none of the three, suddenly announced that she was rescinding her offer because she had heard that I was incompetent. Case closed. Once again, I was casting my net in the biographical waters. At dinner one night, Kate asked if I had any new prospects. I told her that three different publishers who had heard of our friendship said I should write about her. "Yes, you should," she said. "But not while I'm alive." I continued to put feelers out and told the editor I had been assigned at Knopf that I was actively looking for a subject, another great American cultural figure, but because I had written about Perkins and Goldwyn, not somebody from the worlds of publishing or film. When she suggested Italian film director Luchino Visconti, I felt free to roam. At the urging of Phyllis Gran, then head of G.P. Putnam Sons, I began to chase the rights to the papers of Charles Lindbergh. My pursuit took me most of a year. Irene heard the idea and screamed, "Ah, Goyishkeit!" But she saw all the dramatic possibilities of the story of the great hero who became a great victim and a great villain. "I don't like him," she said, "but I want to know more about him, and at my age I can't say that about too many people." Kate adored the idea before I could get it out of my mouth. "I can't wait to read it," she said. "It has everything. Spectacle, tragedy, controversy, mystery, and a love story. You've got to do it." I explained that the rights were complicated, as Lindbergh had evidently died, prohibiting anyone's entry to the papers for years after the death of his wife, and Anne Morrow Lindbergh was very much alive and well. I told Kate that I seemed to be making some inroads with the Lindbergh children, but Mrs. Lindbergh still held the key. "Look," she said, "get me her address, and I'll write her a letter. Do you think that would help?" I said I thought it might, but I wasn't sure. "Do you know her?" I asked. "No," said Kate, "but we had the same doctor for many years, and I think she knows who I am." "Of course she knows who you are," Phyllis interjected, with her lovely way of stating the obvious. "Everybody knows who you are. Why, everybody in the world knows who you are." "Yes, dearie, of course they do. But this is a tricky situation. Think about it. I'll write a letter tomorrow, and you can decide then if I should send it." I said that was a good idea, and a generous one at that, and that we must all keep Mum on the subject. "Oh, don't worry about Phyllis," Kate assured me. "She's an absolute crypt. She's walking around with all sorts of secrets. Of course, she's losing her mind, so God only knows what she even remembers any longer." "That's not true," Phyllis protested. "I remember everything I remember." "Yes, of course, dear." The next day, Kate showed me her letter, which she had entrusted Cynthia to type. It was strong and concise, and we agreed it could only help. Just days after Kate mailed it, I learned that Mrs. Lindbergh was willing to meet me, the first sure sign that the permissions to write her late husband's biography might be mine. Weeks later, they were. Suddenly, I had unique access to some 2,000 boxes of papers, the bulk of which were in Sterling Memorial Library at Yale University in New Haven, about 40 miles down the turnpike from Fenwick. The headquarters for my work for the next few years would become Connecticut, and the time I would get to spend with Kate would increase and intensify. Hepburn continued to become more public than she had in the past. She agreed to show up at benefits for the Actors' Home in New Jersey, to accept an occasional fashion award. "Are you sure they didn't mean Audrey?" I asked her while opening one such invitation, and she pushed an ice cream cone in my face. And to be the guest of honor at the annual Planned Parenthood banquet for which she wrote a long, moving speech. I urged her to conclude her remarks with the statement, "I believe strongly in Planned Parenthood because I had the benefit of a mother and father who planned theirs." But she dismissed it as too corny. In 1990, she accepted one of the prestigious Kennedy Center honors, having refused the decoration several times. When I asked why she had finally agreed to take part in the ceremonies that year, she explained that she just couldn't turn down George Stevens Jr., one of the founders of the award and the son of her former paramour, any longer. "And," she said, "I was waiting until the Reagans were out of the White House because I wanted nothing to do with either of them." She also began to allow documentary filmmakers into her life, into her houses and her history. She sometimes called the night before a shoot, ostensibly about something else, but ultimately to discuss what she might talk about. Katharine Hepburn hardly needed coaching, but I think she was questioning the seemliness at her age of talking about her personal life, notably the one topic she had avoided most of her life, Spencer Tracy. The primary reason she had long held out was Tracy's widow, but Louise Tracy had died in 1983, and Kate had since come to meet their daughter, Susie. She took a real liking to her and repeatedly made a point of saying they were friends. I gave one general piece of advice to Kate, that if she was about to discuss Spencer Tracy in an upcoming documentary, she should not be coy. Kate asked what I meant by that. I said that a lot of people, for a long time, had made certain assumptions about her relationship with him, but that until somebody heard something from her lips, it was hearsay. Only she, I said, knew her true feelings, and if she planned to go public, then she should be specific about them. She asked how frank she should be. Coming from someone who had guarded her privacy so masterfully for so many decades, this question threw me. I could see that she was growing anxious, eager to impart but not to exploit. I suggested she make her comments more about herself than about Tracy, about how she felt. If you could, I asked, what would you say to him today? That, I explained, might show the audience what he meant to her, with 20 years of hindsight. That night, she wrote a letter to Tracy, which allowed her to put some of her thoughts and feelings in perspective. To my amazement, she read it the next day, rather dramatically as it turned out, on camera. My friend Irene once said, I liked Spence, but I never really understood him or what his life with Kate was about. In many ways, neither did Kate. Her open letter to him was largely a litany of questions. Why couldn't he sleep? What did he like to do? What were the demons he was battling? Why the escape hatch of alcoholism to get away from the remarkable you? What was it, Spence? Even more revealing, Kate added, I meant to ask you. Spencer Bonaventure Tracy was born in Milwaukee on April 5th, 1900, the second son of Carrie Brown, a Protestant turned Christian Scientist, and John Tracy, a hard-drinking Irish Catholic whose parents had been refugees from the Great Potato Famine. In one generation, the Tracys had become middle-class, middle-of-the-road Midwesterners, as John worked his way up to becoming general sales manager of a trucking company. According to Kate, who never met him, he worked hard and drank hard and made his two sons toe the line. Spencer often fell short. Possessed of seemingly ordinary intelligence and looks, he stumbled through his youth, getting kicked out of several schools and serving a hitch in the Navy before completing high school and entering Ripon College. He didn't find himself until a dorm mate introduced him to college dramatics. On the Ripon stage, Tracy proved to have a prodigious memory for dialogue and an utterly natural acting style. He suddenly had an identity on campus, doing something at which he excelled. Road companies of Broadway hits often came to Milwaukee, and one provided Tracy his first glimpse of a professional theatrical production, Lorette Taylor in a wildly popular sentimental comedy, Peg of My Heart. By the time the Collegian saw the play, it had become Taylor's war horse, a role she had played on and off for a decade. Kate noted, Spence always said it was the most exciting piece of theater he ever saw in his life. At the end of his first school year, Tracy leapt at an offer to join the Ripon debating team, because it meant a trip to New York City. There he not only saw more plays, but he also auditioned for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Upon his acceptance, he dropped out of Ripon to study acting. His father's unexpected approval of the decision came no doubt because Spencer was self-supporting, receiving a monthly pension as a veteran. He shared a small room with a friend from Milwaukee who was also taking classes at the American Academy, Pat O'Brien. He quickly picked up bit parts, including a non-speaking role as one of the robots in the Theater Guild production of R.U.R. In 1923, Tracy graduated from the Academy and went on to small roles in summer stock. In White Plains, New York, he met Louise Treadwell, the leading lady in his repertory company, which dissolved after one season. When she was offered a similar position in another troupe in Cincinnati, she accepted, on the condition that they hire Spencer Tracy as her leading man. That September, they married. 9.5 months later, their first child was born, a son, John, who they realized a year later was totally deaf. While the boy's condition remained a dark subject into which Hepburn herself seldom delved, she said Spencer felt responsible for the rest of his life. It just didn't seem possible to him that God should have brought such an innocent creature into the world that way, and so it must be his fault. This was his cross to bear, and when he could take it no longer, he drank to forget about it. Kate's few descriptions to me of Tracy's marriage made it sound as though it had been based more on his gratitude toward his wife for believing in him and his talent than love, and that the Tracys' lives were bound together by his feelings of indebtedness and guilt. For a few years, Tracy found little solace in his career. He got a promising part in a forgettable play called A Royal Fandango, starring Ethel Barrymore and featuring a young Edward G. Robinson. But it quickly closed, A framed playbill listing the dramatis personae, Ethel Barrymore at the top of the list and Spencer Tracy at the very bottom, sat on a bookcase in Kate's bedroom. When he sought comfort in bottles and brothels, his wife looked the other way. After almost 7 years of good enough performances in bad plays to keep getting cast again, Spencer Tracy received the lead role of Killer Mears